You're listening to Disturbing the Priest with Brandon Baddick.
Diet just got accepted to be a nominee in the upcoming Grammys, which is super awesome for Best Rock and Metal Performance. What was your reaction to this news?
Well, I was excited because we started talking about it back when the album was coming out this summer, right? And Grammy submissions, and there's the big Grammy, of course, which we got accepted into the voting for the nomination. And the, you know, the tracks, obviously, you know, the metal track's kind of obvious, right? Because, you know, being a metal band. But I think the one that I'm super excited about is, and probably the most impossible to win, is the Best Rock, you know, because, you know, look, it's I've never been in that category before. I've never had anything even submitted into that category, I don't think. And, you know, it's, you know, and it's the song I sing, it's the ballad, right? So just for that alone, just to even have been accepted into the big boys club, I'm good. You know what I mean? And I mean, you know, the thing is when there's a Foo Fighters record out, just kiss that category goodbye, you know? And like this year at Best Metal, there's a Metallica record out, just kiss it goodbye, right? So the chances of winning, you know, just they're almost completely off the plate, you know what I mean? But to be accepted back in, because, you know, look, dude, it's the gold standard, right? And it's, you know, it's the Oscars for music, you know? And so to have, you know, written a record with performances that get recognized and accepted and, you know, sort of applauded by the big boys, you know, sometimes that's really all you need. You know what I mean? It's, I mean, I got a Grammy up here. It's awesome, you know, but the win is nice for sure. But just to even be in the discussion is in this case, awesome, you know.
And it's, as a fan, super awesome to see. And I know it's like right now, you know, you're trying to look forward, you're trying to do your own thing. And this must like really reassure your confidence and like, I'm doing the right thing. And this is the future.
You said it best, you know, and I've had just overwhelming, really unanimous support, you know, for that, you know, just going, man, keep going, brother, you know, and because, you know, look, it's rock and roll. I was in one of these tumultuous, certainly very storied bands for most of my career, you know. How could you expect it to be anything else? You know, it's like being in the Sex Pistols, you know? And so, you know, so the reality of it is now it comes to this time of division. And you know, I was here before 20 years ago when the group was disbanded and I had F5 and some things that I was working on. But, you know, it wasn't my time yet to really kind of be out on my own. I feel like now it is, you know, now I went back to Megadeth, obviously for 11 years, a lot of great stuff, including that Grammy win. But I feel like there's just a lot that I never got to say, you know, and it's fine. Look, groups are what groups are, you know, you go along to get along. But I feel like now is a moment, in time, you know, I've written a lot of music. I've partnered with a lot of different people. Jeff Scott Soto, the Dieth guys, me and Jeff Young are back together working on stuff. Chris Poland, you know, so, you know, there's not only the brotherhood of the past family tree, but there's now new forks and branches to extending and widening that family tree into some other stuff, you know. And, you know, for me, it's always just, first of all, do I like the people and do I like the music? You know, that's always the first thing. You know, it's kind of back to that, you know, when we all got started in this, remember when we all thought, God, wouldn't it be great to be in a band? We'll take on the world. We'll all be best friends. And then, you know, and then you get into the, you know, you work in radio, you know, same for you, right? You get into the business of music and you realize, yeah, it's not about that at all. This is a job and, you know, do your job, you know, to get your check and playing the bass and being in the band is the same thing, man. It's like, do your job, make the biscuits. And I hate that mindset. I've never used that dirty four-letter word called work, you know, in this. I use the other one, play. You know, let's go play music. You know, me and Jeff Young were just on the phone this morning and talking about some stuff. And you know, we get each other excited. You know, it's like, yeah, man, like, you know, we didn't pick up our guitars to have to fucking go to the factory and go to work. You know, we picked up our guitars to do this. Get up with our friends, you know, you, and sit here and talk about music all day. You know, let's do that. That's more fun.
Yeah, you guys have a pretty awesome gig. I can't lie. And a lot of people forget the music business is a business.
It is.
You know?
Well, and it isn't even just music. It's entertainment, right? It's the entertainment business, right? So when you get on that stage, remember me and Kerry King talked about this, you know, it's like, and he said it, he goes, if you don't look and are, if you're not different, you don't deserve to be on that stage. You know, says the man with the devil painted on his head. You know, and I love that. I mean, me and Kerry grew up in the business together, you know, as friends and our respective bands and stuff. And, you know, it's just, it's great to, you know, to you know, he gets it, you know what I mean? And that is true. It is what it is, man. It isn't just about the songs. It's about the stories we tell in the songs. Do these stories connect? You know, it's funny. I just saw Jelly Roll and, with Eric Church the other day of all things. A friend called me, works for Eric Church. I went out and you know, and I'm, you know, I kind of started playing rock and roll at country because I grew up in a farm in Minnesota and everybody's listening to country and western, and then Kiss showed up. I'm like, finally a path forward, you know. and I remember this farmer friend of mine, we were at the Armory in Jackson and there's some country band playing, and you know, it's everybody's drinking and doing what they do, and I was, you know, a teenager, and he says to me, he goes, you know, I just think you could be down there tonight playing for $50. And I said, you know what, fuck that, I'll play rock and roll for free because I ain't playing country, you know. And that was just, it was, you know, the reason it's funny because country's whatever, it's what all the parents liked, right? So you're not gonna do what your parents do, you know. Kiss, our parents hated Kiss, so I'm gonna go with Kiss, you know, that's the obvious choice, you know, that's just how we are growing up, right? Yeah. And you know, so, you know, being a fan of rock and roll, you know, that's what gets me out of bed in the morning, you know. And to get out of bed and know you and I got a conversation here today, it's good reason to get out of bed. Let's go, you know, do a little practicing here today, work on some tunes for some stuff coming up, and you know, that you know, all that kind of stuff. But you know, but back to the Jelly Roll thing, you know, there's a great storyteller, man. You know, I heard his song on the radio when I was in Europe this summer and I went, God, who is this guy? What is this? You know, I didn't know if this was like kind of some Shinedown or, you know, Blackstone Chariot. Is this a band? What is this? And then I learn more about him and I get to see him perform. I'm like, yeah, this guy's cool, man. This guy's like a modern day Johnny Cash or something, you know? So I like guys that's, you know, connect and tell a story. And I think, you know, kind of full circle back to the Dieth Grammy thing, you know, that's what we try to do with our song. Let's tell stories, man. Let's tell stories that are really personal to us. They're heartfelt. They mean something. We're not just making shit up. It's a real, you know, kind of lay it all out there. And, you know, I think those are the songs apparently that get invited to the Grammy dance, you know, things that connect with people.
100%, man. And that's amazing to hear. And I love, I think that's such a funny fact about yourself that you grew up on a farm, especially what you ended up doing as a career.
Right.
Did you have that moment? Because I know a lot of artists and bands have that, like going to the record store, seeing that Motorhead cover and be like, what is this? Like, sure. What was your introduction to the
totally
genre?
Dude. Yeah, I mean, look, Kiss Destroyer. I mean, that was the first record. I mean, look, really, look, I had me and my brother rode the school bus for like an hour every morning. We get picked up at 7:15 and we get dropped off at school at 8:15. So I had an hour on the school bus.
Wow.
You know, and for a couple of years or two, there was a bus driver that would listen to WLSAM, which is a big station out of Chicago, and it would broadcast over to where I was in rural central, south central Minnesota. And so I heard, I mean, man, as soon as I heard Ballroom Blitz, it was like, I'm in, whoever this is, I'm in, right? So it's really, it started with Sweet. I got to be honest with you. Wow. Sweet, and then Bachman Turner Overdrive. We had a farmhand who had the Not Fragile album on 8-track. And, you know, we had nice John Deere equipment, so I'd always want to go ride with him, you know. And, you know, I wasn't up for farm work, but driving the tractor was okay because they were nice. I mean, they were like driving a Mercedes down the field. You know, they were nice, and they had 8-tracks, so they could listen. And so I listened to rock, you know. You know, BTO, I remember listened, you know, I got to know the Ramones, the Rocket to Russia, you know, so these are the things that I grew up with. And then, you know, Kiss Destroyer, like I heard Shout It Out Loud on the radio and it was in jukeboxes around the area, you know, we got to dinner or something. And, you know, so then I saw Kiss play on the Paul Lynde Halloween special, which I've seen, it's on YouTube. If you go check it out, dude, it's awesome. I mean, it's like, you know, you see that when you're 12 years old, you're just like, yeah, I don't want to be a fireman or a doctor anymore. Now I want to go do that. You know, that's what it was, you know, and you know, for whatever reason, the good Lord, you know, put some musical talent in me and gave me the hunch that I should play the bass guitar of all freaking instruments. You know, I was playing tenor sax in the orchestra band as a kid, and I didn't like it, you know. And then, you know, a lot of people talk about their moment with the Beatles, you know. Well, mine was Kiss. They were my Beatles, you know. So that's the thing that I just really got on board with. And, you know, they were my everything, you know, and everything we learned about, you know, cool shit in rock and roll came from them. And then after that, Van Halen, and then Judas Priest and Boston, and then Motorhead, and, you know, Def Leppard, and, you know, all through the stuff, you know. And then, you know, by the time I got to California in 83, you know, this other scene was taken off. The US Festival had just happened, which was huge. On the rock and roll day, that had Van Halen, Judas Priest, Scorpions, Motley, and Quiet Riot were the early bands of the day, and they were, you know, making noise on MTV. And so kids like me in the Midwest, as I was getting ready for my pilgrimage out to California to start my career, you know, they were the ones making some noise, and it was cool, you know. And then when I get there, I meet Dave, and then I learn about Metallica, and Yngwie had just gotten there and was playing in Steeler with Ron Keel, and Loudness had just come over. I remember seeing Loudness. I think Loudness was the headliner and Steeler with Yngwie open for them. Wow. At the country club. So it was just a great moment, you know. And it's funny, you know, it's all kind of divinely led, you know, meaning just, you know, follow your heart, you know. When my gut at 16 told me go to California, I just followed it, you know, and I just stayed the course, and I played in all my bands, gigged and worked the circuit in the area in the Midwest. And I was really young, obviously. So I had to have I had an older sound man guy who, he just died actually a month ago or so, but he was like our hero, you know. He'd co-sign. He was like 20 or 21. So he'd get us into the bars and the clubs so we could gig and play. And he'd sort of sign the waiver. All right, I'll be the guardian for these kids, you know, and, you know, he'd let us sneak a few beers and have some fun, you know, once in a while. But you know, because he was a rocker, man. And, you know, he was kind of the band big brother, you know, that helped me get into the thing and so I could have my chops together. So by the time I got to California, you know, look, I'd done my homework. I'd been in the trenches back in the Midwest for what
Oz
that was worth
as well.
Yeah, what's that? Taz? Yeah, Taz. Yeah. Like Taz, and then it became Killers, right, after Iron Maiden. That's why when bands name themselves after Megadeth songs like Darkest Hour, these tribute bands like Hey, You're 18. I mean, I get it, dude. I was in one of those, you know. And, you know, we were with Killers and Taz. We were trying to make our way, but, you know, there's nothing cooking in southwestern Minnesota. You know what I mean? So I had to get to where the action is, you know. And today it's a different day because, with the internet, you know, you can make noise, you know, on the internet and get people to come to you. But, you know, in my day, you know, we had to move to where the action was. And in my day, that was LA, you know, so that's
Bay Area. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And it's funny, the Bay Area, as I would learn with Dave and Metallica, you know, they moved there to get Cliff Burton in the band. And, you know, how ironic, because, you know, the Bay Area, Exodus was really the band up there. And as you watch like Murder in the Front Row, you really realize Exodus were the star of the show, you know, to so much that they got their guitar player, Kirk Hammett, in the band in Metallica, you know. So Exodus was really the band making the noise. And even when we went up there and debuted Megadeth, when Kerry King played with us, once Kerry saw Exodus, that totally changed his arc of what he would then do with Slayer, you know.
Wow.
I mean, he always told me, he goes, Tom Hunting's my favorite drummer, you know. So I kind of always had this feeling like he, you know, I don't, you know, Dave Lombardo's Lombardo. He doesn't need, he doesn't need crafting and sculpting. He's fucking Dave Lombardo, you know what I mean? But I always felt like Kerry kind of took that Tom Hunting Exodus, you know, that was sort of the footprint to take back to LA. And, you know, it was interesting that, you know, look, Metallica moved there, suddenly they're now a big fish in a different pond, you know. In LA, if you're Metallica, you're just another band amongst a gazillion other bands, you know. So it's funny that they're, you know, Lars moving the band up to the Bay Area, that was genius, right? Because suddenly they're like something cool and special up in a town that didn't have anything like that, you know. So and then from there, the Bay Area thrash scene thrived, you know. And So it's, you know, it's funny how just one or two moves on the chessboard can change the whole game.
It really is. I'd love to know. So you left when you were like 16. What was your introduction to thrash metal?
Well, so 16, I had the hunch. My parents made me finish school. I went up and I told them at 16, I said, "Hey, I'm moving to California tomorrow." They're like, "Yeah, slow down there, little fighter. You know, you're finishing school." Thank God they did. You know, I'm glad I got a high school degree, because then later in life I'd go to college and, you know, do adulting, you know, adult stuff. But yeah, so at 18, I mean, literally 5 days after high school, me and some buddies moved to LA. And you know, thrash, it's funny, you know, I think it was maybe Malcolm Dome. I think he's in the Murder in the Front Row movie. I point because I have the book over here. That's why I'm pointing over this way. But, you know, I think in the film, you know, some journalists dubbed, you know, Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, this new scene, you know, Anthrax, Overkill, you know, Exodus, Testament, this new scene, they called it thrash metal. And you know really thrash was kind of like the skaters in Venice Beach, you know, and skating was a big part of that scene, and that's Suicidal Tendencies and all this stuff, you know. So there's kind of this punk, you know, the thrashers were the skaters, right? So this kind of got dubbed to be our music, and sort of dubbed by a journalist, not by us, you know. Us musicians didn't come up with we didn't come up with that name, you know. You know, my introduction to it, I mean, look, my first introduction to Metallica was Dave playing the No Life to Leather demo, which I thought was fucking awesome, man. I mean, it was dark, it was fast, it was unhinged, you know. It was, you know, and again, we'd sit around, and Dave had some Diamond Head records. Of course, I knew of Motorhead, I knew of Saxon. We'd listen to, you know, I'd not heard Accept, so like Restless and Wild, Fast as a Shark, this kind of stuff, right? So, which was great, you know. I mean, the Accept records sounded so good. They had a great production to them. And kind of, yeah, to me, stood a little above the rest of them, you know. And that's one thing I always liked about Metallica records. They always sounded good. You know, Lars always took the time to get great drum tone. And I guess when you're the boss and the leader, you know, you can do that. You know what I mean? So he'd always get great. And of course, we all knew of Maiden and this kind of stuff. But, you know, Motorhead were kind of the next ones coming up. And I remember Dave telling me, he said, you know, Lars wanted to be America's Motorhead. You know, that was kind of the initial vision, you know, and it was, you know, Motor Breath. You know, what is this, Whiplash? There's a song, because we played with Dieth, we played We Are the Road Crew. We played only like once, just to kind of have a bonus track to fill some time. And they'd make me sing this shit. Like, I'm not even the singer. Suddenly now I'm the singer, right?
Apparently,
so,
yeah.
I guess so. I guess they saw something in me that I did not. So I, you know, I worked. We played Turn Up the Night, you know, Mob Rules.
Awesome.
I remember to sing fucking Ronnie Dio. Fortunately, we're tuned down to C, so I can sing it. It's in my sort of baritone range. But, you know, as I'm going through these lyrics, I see, you know, Metallica totally nicked. There's a lyric in We Are the Road Crew. They totally grabbed for Whiplash. The you know, driving like a maniac, not to hell and back, is the Motorhead lyric.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And they totally clipped that, you know, driving like a maniac. Whiplash, right? So you know, that's how close to it that it was. And you know, they weren't plagiarizing, they're just borrowing from their favorite artist. You know what I mean? So shit happens.
You find that out all the time, I feel, especially now with the internet, people saying, "Hey, this sounds like this." Even the whole thing with the Four Horsemen, how there's like that Lynyrd Skynyrd lick in it.
Well, Dave, okay. And again, I'm paraphrasing what was told to me. So Dave told me Lars wanted like a Skynyrd, like a Sweet Home Alabama part. Dave said he just kind of farted that out, you know, sort of almost as a, I don't know if it was a joke or just kind of played it. And Lars like, "Yeah, that's the part." And they kept it, you know. So that's how that
now it's on the record.
Now it's on the record. Yeah. So David Olufsen said, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about the mega years, I do want to talk about some of the singers you guys auditioned. Johnny Cyrus of Agent Steel.
Yeah.
Was supposed to be the singer.
Well, we auditioned all these guys. So Johnny Cyrus. Yeah. Who else do you have on your list? Remind me. Because there was a.
I the the guy from Diamond Head, I believe, if I remember that correctly.
Yeah, that never. I mean, he joined us on Clash of the Titans when we played at Wembley. He came up and sang "It's Electric" with us because Dave was a fan of his. Sean Harris, but yeah, I don't think was meant to be. You know, remember, there's this one kind of Billy Idol looking British guy that we auditioned and say, yeah, this is not, I don't even think he made it to the rehearsal room. We just went over to his house in Van Nuys or his apartment. Like, yeah, this is the guy. And then these other guys would come in, cool guys, you know, they were all like well coiffed in their scarves and their, you know, they looked the part, but you're like, yeah, this ain't the guy, you know? And that's like what, like when Kerry King came in, because Jim Durkin from Dark Angel was kind of jamming with us a little bit. And he was really young, you know, and his chops just weren't quite there, you know. And of course, he'd go on to do great things with Dark Angel, and we all love Jim, God rest his soul. But it's funny, when Kerry came in, he was my age, so he was, you know, kind of in the right age group. His skills were a little more polished, and he really got Dave. You know, he saw Dave play, you know, with Saxon at the Whiskey or something when Metallica opened for him, and you know. I mean, Kerry said it. He goes, look, that changed his life. It changed his musical arc of his whole career and his guitar playing. And so he, you know, he loved it. He loved being in a band with Dave, you know, and he could just recite these riffs right back. Dave would show him something and he'd fucking play it right back. I was like, geez, man, like this was cool, you know, because like with my bass playing, like we created a sound, we created a style, you know, as bands should. Bands create something together, you know. It's, you know, you create and carve out a, you know, sort of a path forward, you know. And for me, look, I came into town, you know, teed up, ready to go. My chops were good. My musical sensibilities were good. I studied. I practiced. My gear was together. My chops were good. I had a good head on my shoulders to do it. So, you know, it was kind of like, you know, getting with Dave is like, okay, this is the direction, you know? So, and that's what we did. So it was fun to, you know, to be part of the next thing. That was exciting. You know, that was definitely cool. So, but yeah, I mean, look, at one point, another singer flaked out. Literally, I think it was New Year's Eve of 1983. We were down at Curly Joe's studio, which is this brewery downtown off of I-5. I drive by it all the time now when I go to Chris Poland's rehearsal place. I drive by, on the left is General Hospital. If you come from the north, from Burbank, right, on the left is General Hospital, on the right is the brewery. And I look at it and go, fuck, you know, man, that's where we rehearsed all those early years with Lee Rausch, you know, when Kerry King came in, when Jim Durkin was playing with us, when we were auditioning all these singers. And now with that, on New Year's Day, just literally takes fucking a sheet of lyrics and just tapes it up onto like a mic stand, you know, and or pins it up there somehow, and we play the song and he sings it. And I was the one that I go, dude, come on. Like, that was fucking great, you know? And he's like, really? I said, dude, I said, you're writing the lyrics. Who's going to sing these songs better than you? So, you know, it sort of forced him to be the singer, you know? And he was kind of, I don't think you know, at a day, it's funny. His first thing he said was, well, splitting the money with four guys is better than five, you know, just you're being silly, you know,
yeah,
the jokester that he would be, you know. And but it was funny. I could tell he's like, okay, if he's got a sense of humor about it, he'd probably get his mind around it. And then that changed it, man. And it was that, then we became a four piece, you know. So, and it was like, all right, dude, you're singing. And, you know, and then to sing and play is kind of the Geddy Lee thing, you know, because the stuff's pretty intense, you know. But he was good at it, man. You know, he was able to, you know, it's this deal, you know, where you're, you know, doing two different skills.
Yeah.
Know? So it was, you know, he did it, you know, so that was that.
Yeah,
singer,
man.
Settled, you know.
Yep. That was figured out. Very interesting to hear. I'd love to know. So, co-founded one of the most important bands of all of metal. The 90s was a really rough era for the genre. But at least we got, in my opinion, the greatest thrash metal record of all time, Rust in Peace. I'd love to know what you remember about the writing and recording process of that record, as well as where was everyone creatively during the making of that album?
Well, for Megadeth, the first 5 years of the 90s were awesome. I mean, that was when we, you know, got all this gold and platinum and life was great, right? I mean, we really had a big upswing coming off of Rust in Peace, going into Countdown, even Euthanasia and Cryptic even.
Great records.
But you're right. Then, you know, the Seattle thing just completely changed the fucking course of the earth, you know. So as a group of bands will do, you know. But yeah, you look, rest in peace. Look, we were a mess, you know. We were junkies, we were a mess. You know, it was started out as me, Dave, Chuck, and Jeff, and then it was me, Dave, and Chuck, and then it was me and Dave. And then we got Nick Menz in the band, and then at least it was me, Dave, and Nick. And then we got a good manager, Ron Lafitte, came in. He'd wanted to manage us for a few years, and I finally sat down with Dave. I said, look, I think he's the best guy for the job. And Ron would come over as we're smoking crack and doing heroin and doing drugs. He'd sit patiently in the apartment with us and hear us out, and, you know, and he was just very patient, you know. And he studied under Tim Collins, who was managing Aerosmith, you know, who got Aerosmith sober, you know, just working with him on how to do this. How do I get these guys cleaned up? I mean, fuck, they're at Capitol Records. The whole world is ready for them. It's theirs to have. And he told us that. He goes, listen, guys, it's all yours to have, but you got to get clean, you know. And so, and of course, most of that pressure was on Dave, you know, being the leader and the singer and stuff. So, you know. And I needed to get clean too, you know, and to support. So we all had to do it together, and that's how it happened, you know. So we got 89 was writing of the record plus trying to get clean, somehow make a path forward. And by early 90, we were all finally on the right path. Marty came into the band, of course, and you know, and then to record the record, you know, was sort of the transition. I mean, I was like maybe a month sober when I was recording the bass, you know. And when you're coming clean off,
wow.
That shit, man, your fingers hurt, your body hurts, you just feel like shit. And I'd sort of detoxed since like November, so I was kind of getting clean. I wasn't totally coming fresh off of a, you know, heroin Jones, but you know, getting clean. And I remember sitting in my couch in my apartment in Studio City, and I was going, I hit my bass, and you know, I was like, oh fuck, do I even want to do this anymore? And this immediate thought came right after it, said, you know, you started playing when you were a kid and you loved it, and the drugs just got in the way. And it's funny, you know, how these little sort of, you know, again, these little divine sprinkles come into your mind and pass through your heart and inspire you. And I went, yeah, that's right. I didn't get into this to sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That was all, you know, that was just some lie that we were all sold, you know. That's all bullshit, you know. So, you know, that was the old, you know, adage from the 70s and the 80s and shit. I was like, yeah, that's all a lie. That's bullshit. So I was like, yeah, let's get going, you know. And so, yeah, you know, we turned that corner, and as we all, you know, got clean and stayed clean together, and Marty and Nick weren't, you know, druggies. They were fine. But, you know, that's what got us in the studio and made the record and you know, turned up the tempos and turned up the ferocious nature of it. And so we wrote the album high and recorded it sober. seemed to work.
Hell yeah.
If you could do that with every album, you probably would. But, you know, chances of getting clean again are probably zero. So why go back there, you know?
The duality. So,
yeah.
Hey, brother,
I got to jump on another interview right after this.
Maybe yeah, no worries, man.
One more question. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry to cut it short.
No worries at all. Let's just circle back to Dieth.
Sure.
What was the writing recording process of To Hell and Back?
So, you know, it's funny. I was sent in the Hall of the Hanging Serpent first back in probably January of 2022. I was introduced to Glitterme on email from a mutual friend, and he sent the tune over. I went in the studio here. I played bass on it. I liked it. It was very cool. It was clever riffing. And then I heard the final track. I was literally outside here on my patio by the pool, and Glitterme called, and we're talking, and he goes, man, this sounds great, and we should do some more. And I said, yeah, sure, why not? You know, because people are always like, oh, David Olsen's in 20 bands, and da, da, da. And it's like, you know, listen, you know, I've been in bands my whole life, right? A couple of them have actually been successful. One in particular, right? Straight to the top. But, you know, Metal Legions, you know, I've played with Cavaleras and, you know, Max and Al from Ministry. You know, I'm a musician, right? We make music. And, you know, it's like they're all projects. You know, if it's just a project or a band, well, I tell you what, if it sells records and people want to come and see it and buy a ticket, it becomes a real, you know. If it isn't, then it's just a moment you had, you made some music together, you move on, you know. And, you know, it's just that simple. I mean, it's, you know, I think people gets, you know, into this, is this a, you know, you, how committed are you? I'm like, I'm as fucking committed as you're willing to support it. You know, that's that. I mean, of course I'm committed to the music, that otherwise I wouldn't have done it. But after you put the music out, it's kind of out of your hands, you know, what's going to happen with it, you know, same with Diet. So when Glarmay said, hey, let's write some more, I said, sure, let's do it. And, you know, we, one day we popped, we were just kind of bored in the summer. And we said, you know what? Let's put that song up on my Facebook. Let's put it on YouTube. We'll pop it out. And all of a sudden it blew up. I mean, we had huge hits. Napalm came to the table and it's like, you know, this is how this works, right? When someone's interested in what you're doing, you stay committed to it, you know? And, you know, that, and that's how it is. Right. So, yeah. You know, I mean, I put out a couple of great F5 records. It just didn't really get the traction. So set it to the side, you go on to the next one, you know, and that's, you know, look, if Megadeth had never gotten any traction, I would have moved off onto the next one. I mean, that's just how life is, right? So, you know, so this one got traction, you know, and we stayed the course. We committed to it for this album cycle, and now we're, you know, making the plans for the next one. And you know, so having a label like Napalm and, you know, getting these Grammy acceptance and all this stuff. I mean, look, these are the things that keep the wind in the sails, and we've been writing now for the last couple of months since we've been off the road. And so, you know, we're looking forward to the next one now, you know. And well, look, we got the show coming up with Metal Allegiance at NAMM, which is great. That's kind of our first American footprint here. Exciting. You know, cause that's the thing, is how do we get the band over here? I mean, like, it's easy for me to fly to Poland and go over there, cause I'm just one dude. And look, being an American, it's a lot easier to travel the world. You know, the American passport gets you a lot of places that other people from other countries, you got to deal with work visas. It's very problematic, as we're now learning, even coming over to do NAMM. You know, you got to get ahead of this shit months ahead. There's a lot of logistics and immigration issues, and, you know, so I can move around the world much easier, you know, and it's easier for me to just kind of go jump into something over there with these guys. And but this NAMM thing will be great. I'm really excited that we finally get to bring it here. I'm certainly stoked to be, you know, Metal Allegiance, you know, our 10-year anniversary. So it's all good. NAMM's back. We got the Ellison coffee booth that's going to be there. We just announced that today.
Awesome.
So, you know, yeah, so, you know, play some rock and roll, have some coffee, come over to the booth, kick back, chill out, you know, and then go fire it up at the House of Blues, you know.
Very exciting. David Ellefson, thank you so much for doing this.
You're
man.
Welcome.
Really means a
You're
lot. I'm Brandon Baddick, yeah. And this is Disturbing the Priest.